Joining us in this podcast is an old friend, namely Peter Wood. You may well recognize that name. He is the president of the National Association of Scholars, NAS. Peter, it's more or less incumbent upon me, I suppose, in current style, to instantly declare, in the spirit of full disclosure, that I'm on your board of advisors. Though I don't think I've had much to do with shaping the course that NAS has taken in recent years. You have a great deal to do with that, and your tenure, it's now about 5 or 6 years, is it not?
Yes, I was appointed president in 2009, and I was the executive director for a few years before that.
Yeah, and that has really invigorated NAS, and it remains the major watchdog over the, what shall we call it, the continuing decline or the continuing transformation or the continuing revivification leftwards of American higher education?
Well, all of those could be true.
Well, why has it happened? Well, first, what's the evidence that it has happened?
Well, the evidence comes in many forms. One place to start is with the tilt of scholarship to a more politicized vein of discourse, I guess we call it these days, in the humanities and social sciences. The result of that change in research has been a transformation of the curriculum towards courses that engage in advocacy, sometimes explicitly so, other times woven into the fabric of the course in a more subtle way. But the college curriculum has become more and more a platform for helping young men and women escape the trammels of their bourgeois upbringing and bringing them into the progressive fold. And that seems to me to be a major part of the story of that transformation of higher education we've seen. Of course, there are other important stories going on that are connected with it. There's this phenomenon called the higher education bubble, where we have found the increased costs of attending college have gone up exorbitantly at a rate higher than the cost of health inflation.
What's the average now, $50,000 or $60,000 a year?
I don't know what the national average is, but if we limit our discussion to selective liberal arts colleges, it's about $50,000 a year.
Yeah. At the University of Chicago, with which I've been associated for so long, it is over $50,000 a year. And that's true of all the major universities, I guess, the prestigious or prestigeful universities, though they always claim that they have a lot of scholarship programs which tend to lessen the bite.
And that's true. There is a Robin Hood philosophy that is talked about technically as the discount rate. That is, those who can afford it pay the sticker value, and those who cannot obtain a combination of loans and scholarships that is meant to make college more affordable. It is something of an illusion, however, in that many students end up graduating from college with quite substantial debts, and many
students
do not even make it through college, walk away from college with a portfolio of debts that will take them decades to pay off.
Now, NAS has focused on what would have to be designated as sort of the left radicalization or the left movement of the American professoriate. But surely, though that may be the case in the so-called social sciences, and for that matter in the humanities, it is not necessarily or not even likely the case in the hard sciences, is it?
No, the hard sciences have not been exempt from this movement, but they're not dominated by politics. That is to say, one can certainly find plenty of people working in the sciences whose political persuasions are on the academic left, but that tends not to be the dominant factor in their appointment or their teaching.
And it's pretty hard to politicize a course in calculus or in thermodynamics.
Indeed.
So it's essentially the humanities and the social sciences. Where, in fact, does the left polarization show more fully? In the one, social sciences, or the other, humanities?
No, I'd be hard put to draw that distinction.
It's pretty pervasive in both, I gather.
It is, and then there are fields such as history, which partake of both the social sciences and the humanities.
To be sure, yeah.
Almost overwhelmingly politicized. So,
is it, as some argue, as some on the left do argue, is it inevitably the outcome of a basic fact of human nature, namely that the more intelligent you are, the more intelligent you are, the more intelligent you are, the more you tend to perceive through all the mist of political argument and confusion that truth lies in the direction of social justice and a concern for rectification of social inequality from which we and the world have suffered for many, many years?
That's a self-serving illusion on the part of the left. They like to counsel themselves, or maybe even console themselves, that the exclusion of conservatives, libertarians, anyone who's not on the left from the academy makes no difference, because that's the result is the absence of people who aren't very bright. The trouble, of course, is that it's a circular sort of argument. You exclude a certain group of people, and then you pretend that they didn't want to be there in the first place. I think that we have abundant evidence over the last, say, 2,500 years that there are plenty of people who are not on the progressive left who have interesting, important, and powerful things to say. They exist today, but you find them more often represented in think tanks and in industry and in sort of other places than on the typical college campus.
And this characterization of the typical college campus and university campus holds apparently not merely for the United States, but more broadly for all the Western world. Is that the case?
I don't know of a Western nation where it has not taken a deep root. I was recently visiting the counterpart of the National Association of Scholars in Canada, the Society for Academic Freedom and Scholarship, and if anything, the situation in Canada is even worse than it is in the United States. And certainly we hear stories about this sort of in Germany and England and France, so we know that it's a phenomena of Western civilization that our institutions that are primarily responsible for cultivating in students a knowledge, appreciation, understanding of their own history and civilization have in a profound way turned against that legacy and are now teaching that Western civilization is in its root a bad enterprise, one that's associated with oppression, sexism, and a variety of other forms of illiberal treatment of our fellow humanity.
Would you not have to say, just in broad characterization of our intellectual and, for that matter, of our institutional history, that Marxism has prevailed? To be sure, the great Marxist state, the Soviet Union, came apart. But the sensibility of Marxism as a critique of institutions and forms and content of culture, that persists in the world, and in many ways it has had a victory despite the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right. Well, it's not hard to find contemporary academics who proudly self-identify as Marxist, or if not owning the term Marxist for who they are, will proudly say that Marxist analysis of one form or another is part of what they do. So that's one piece of it. A broader piece of it is that some of the key ideas of Marxism have bleached out into other areas where people may not even be self-consciously using them, but are using them nonetheless. So this notion that there is no disinterested truth, that everything is political, that the study of history inevitably serves the interest of some dominant group, all of that is a kind of diluted form of Marxism that has now become the second nature of the university.
One can't predict the future, but the past always has about it the stamp of inevitability, because it happened, so causes must have pushed us in that direction. What tended to make this whole transformation of scholarly life and of academic institutions more or less the rule in the Western world? How finally do we account for if not the radicalization, at least the progressivization, if such a word exists, of the academy.
Well, I think that's a deep topic, and one can pick it up in a variety of places.
To be sure, yes.
A place that I'll immediately pick it up is that World War I was a great catastrophe for Western civilization. Our most civilized countries, France and Germany, tore themselves apart. We had as a phenomena of the outcome of World War I, the lost generation, these people who began to look back at Western civilization as Ezra Pound called it a botched civilization. But so the roots of alienation from our own culture go back at least a century. And during that time, much of it was the period of the Soviet Union, which relentlessly propagandized that the West was a bad place. When the Soviet system began to fall apart and the wheels were falling off political communism, what remained was this aftertaste of viewing the West as primarily an opponent.
Yeah. Permit a moment's interruption. I want you to go on with the main line of argument you're developing. But I've noted something which really confounds me. The Soviet Union no longer exists. Russia is supposedly committed to more or less capitalist forms or reform. Yet if you look at the Russian television news service, which is now making a big play all around the world and is indeed has established a major center in Washington from which they do a good deal of their broadcasting, it sounds almost as if they're working from a well-worn copy of Das Kapital. They are still as crudely in communist-like form criticizing American capitalism, American institutions, and the general evil of American corporate life and American cultural life. And we're still sacrificing normal, decent human values to the sheer corruption of capitalist ambition and capitalist selfishness. That's what they're saying in stuff that they're broadcasting on American cable television all the time under Russian sponsorship. What do you make of that?
Well, I make of it that a 75-year history of political tyranny and educational malfeasance isn't overturned in 23 or 24 years of relative freedom. People's cultural habits get settled, and the individuals who run the media in any country are the products of the kind of education they had in their youth. So the residue of the Soviet system still plays out in the lives of Russians,
yeah.
And we will be paying the same sorts of dues to our own history 25 years down the road. There is a cost to be paid for our educational system, sunk as it is in a kind of cultural self-loathing.
Yeah. Back to your more general analysis, something I would suggest, and I'm sure you would agree with this, that really further pushed us in the direction that we both agree we have gone in, is somehow the rise of a doctrine concerning the human differentiation and concerning the equal acceptability of all modes of existence, all modes of preference, all modes of, for that matter, sexual as well as gustatory enthusiasm, and the necessity for purging our institutions of any kind of discrimination which might be a reflection of, quote, prejudice against one or another group. We are indeed super tolerant, and we are super intolerant of the expression of critical commentary from across one to another sector of the society.
Two things happened. As the economic analysis of Marxism faltered, the left turned to identity politics and the idea that the racial groups and the like were the new frontier for pressing for radical transformation of society. I think that's a major piece of this.
So it begins with the civil rights struggle of American blacks, but surely that was a legitimate and a desirable struggle.
Right. America has its own history. its own genuine oppression to be overcome. And there was a liberal movement, liberal not in the progressive sense, but in the genuinely liberal sense, of trying to live up to our ideals. The civil rights movement made major strides in that. It wasn't really until the late 1960s that it began that the left turned away from a struggle for equal rights to this much more insidious form of giving preferences to groups based on their heritage of oppression. And that took full flower once the Supreme Court gave us the diversity doctrine in 1978, and colleges and universities ran with it through the 1980s and 1990s to create a system of higher education that put identity groups at the forefront of what should be taught and how it should be taught. Now, I think that's one piece of this. Another thing that's happened that bears very much on this is that the American love of equality, which is a real thing, has mutated into a notion favored by elites more than the common people, but nonetheless favored, and that is that equality now must consist of a distribution of group rights rather than individual rights. And our sense of justice gets perverted through that as well, that if you can claim justice for your cause in America and persuade people that what you're advocating for is genuinely just, you will usually win the argument. I think that explains how the movement for gay marriage went from virtually nowhere within 10 years to being now favored by basically the entire American political class.
Is there a further movement a further direction that movement might take after the full establishment of gay rights and gay marriage? There are those writing critically who suggest that what comes next is polyandry or something of the sort. That is a reaffirmation of the right to multiple marriages rather than just marriages between two people.
Well, Milt, you're inviting me to go way out on a limb, but I'm up to the challenge. I don't know what the future will bring. I do think that in the gay rights movement, the two frontiers that look most likely to be explored are the movement towards multiple partners.
Yeah.
And the other one is the age of consent. And there is clearly something going on both those fronts. The move to polyandry, of course, isn't limited to a gay rights agenda, but it's a further dissolution of the traditional standards of marriage to have multiple partners linked in multiple ways. And you know, all of this bodes very well to the left here that sees marriage as the institution that organizes inequality. It bodes very well to some young Americans who think that everything should be about individual choice. It bodes very poorly to an anthropologist like me who sees the family and marriage as the linchpin institution of not just our society, but any society.
And to a psychologist like me who sees it exactly the same way. I note, just in terms of intellectual history, that in a way this whole view of the family as an oppressive institution is Marxian in that it was formulated in a particular book by Marx's closest partner, Friedrich Engels.
Yes. Marriage, family, and the origin of the state, I think.
Yeah. Let me take you in another direction, namely some of the studies that NAS has done. I haven't talked enough about, or got you talking enough about NAS and its very major undertakings and its very active membership. By the way, it is essentially an organization of college professors, though yet others, I suppose, in some categories belong. What's the number of active members these days?
About 3,000.
And is that what it has always been, or has it increased or decreased or what?
It's gone up and down. I think at our peak back in the mid-1990s, we were about 5,000.
Uh-huh.
And we dipped way down, and in the last two or three years, we've come up again. So it's a history of sort of varied fortunes, depending on how much we have projected ourselves into the major public debates.
NIS has done many very interesting studies, and I should have mentioned earlier that, of course, it has a major journal, which appears, I think, as a quarterly journal, called Academic Questions, in which excellent and very important research is reported, as well as analytic pieces of high quality. One thing that you've recently undertaken is a study of what they do with the curriculum and what they do in college life at a well-known American liberal arts college, well-known because it's been there for a long time, though we haven't paid much attention to it particularly. It's a place up in Maine called Bowdoin College.
Yes, Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. It is a very old college. It was in the first crop of colleges founded after the successful American Revolution, when Maine was still part of Massachusetts. Massachusetts chartered it in, I think it was 1793. It took a while for it to open its doors, but in the early 19th century, its graduates included people like Nathaniel Hawthorne and Longfellow, Franklin Pierce, a future president of the United States. And during the Civil War, one of the great heroes who led the charge up Little Round Top at Gettysburg was a man named Joshua Chamberlain. Chamberlain was a Bowdoin grad, a Bowdoin professor, and later the president of the college. So it's a college that does have a significant American history to it, an important place that held to its academic standards all the way through the 20th century up until the mid-1960s, and then it began to get a little bit uncertain about what kind of place it really wanted to be. In 1969, it appointed as its president a man named Roger Howells. Howells was another Bowdoin graduate, who'd been a Rhodes Scholar, came back from Oxford with a DPhil in history, and he was a specialist on Cromwell. And he was purely a man of the 1960s. He bought everything that the 60s had to offer. That tradition by itself was a terrible thing to be overcome, that students needed to be, his word, liberated, that liberal education should consist not of being taught something by people who thought they already knew it, but by a process of self-discovery. So he enunciated all of this in his inaugural speech and lived up to it fully. Within a very short time, Bowdoin abolished all of its core curricular requirements, all of its general education. It had been a male school. It became co-ed. He made the scholastic aptitude test optional. He created the first studies programs, one in African American studies and one in environmental studies. He made the college into something that would have been utterly unrecognizable during its first 150 years or so. And it became, however, the college that it is today. So what National Association of Scholars did was over 18 months, we undertook our most far-reaching study ever. We burrowed deep into the history and the current sociology of the college. We examined its curriculum, student life, the faculty. We wanted to create a 360-degree rounded picture of what one contemporary liberal arts college looks like. Now, I hasten to add that while we did all this with this one small college, we did it with the idea that this was an enterprise in examining a microcosm, that what we would find at this college would, with suitable adaptation, be the picture that applies pretty much to other elite liberal arts colleges, and with a few more adaptations to higher education as a whole. Now, that's a hypothesis. Having studied one college in depth, I can't instantly say that every other place is just like that. On the other hand, in the several months that the report has been out, I have been recipient of dozens upon dozens of emails and phone calls and letters from people saying, you could have taken my college and substituted its name wherever you wrote both.
Uh-huh.
You'd have exactly the same thing. So
I'm
pretty strong in the conviction that we got it right.
A song tag comes to mind. which is really almost irresponsible of me, but all the same, from Oklahoma. Everything's up to date in Kansas City. They've gone about as far as they can go. Has Bowdoin gone about as far as it can go?
Probably not. You mentioned a little earlier that the sciences are immune to most of the political nonsense. And
I would hope so, certainly.
I believe that's true at Bowdoin. A student who goes there to study the sciences will get a good, rich program. There are a few departments. My friend Stanley Kurtz refers to them as reverse islands. That is, it used to be the case that you might have some strange programs in the midst of a general ocean of good stuff, but now you have a few islands of good stuff in an ocean of dubious things. So at Bowdoin College, there's one department that really stands out. It's called government. Most places call it political science.
Yeah.
But there's several outstanding professors there, one named Gene Yarborough, maybe known to some of the listeners, who teach the Federalist Papers. They look at the American founding in depth. They have a really well-rounded and well-grounded view of what government entails, and they teach it well.
So they stand in opposition to most of their faculty colleagues. How does the rest of the faculty respond to what's happening in the Department of Government?
Well, I think I discern two responses. One of them is actually, thank goodness, because if it weren't for the existence of a department that broke ranks and did things that way, the college really would be outed as hardly anything other than an arm of propaganda for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But the existence of the government department puts the lie to that picture. The other thing, though, is that they view the department as likely to age out soon. The conservatives, the only conservatives in the whole college who are in that department, are near the ends of their careers. And when they go, Bowdoin certainly will not replace them with like-minded people. So there's a sense in which they can just bide their time and wait for this exception to the rule of political correctness to right itself in favor of the campus orthodoxy.
You know, there is a curious corner in the reorganization and transformation of American institutions of higher education. It preoccupies me just a bit. To confess that it preoccupies me may mark me as a prude. All the same, I'll turn a touch autobiographical. My first academic job after I got my doctorate was at Yale, and I was very enthusiastic to be there, and they kept me for 6 years and then sent me packing, which was their right. In more recent years, Yale has gone through a very significant transformation, and not addressing all the other ways in which it has changed, though it has changed in terms of its curriculum and in terms of what it will allow with regard to political advocacy and what it will urge for political advocacy. But apart from all of that, one big institution that has flourished at Yale, developed only some years ago, not very long ago, is Sex Week, in which there are lots of parades in which kids run around naked. And in which prostitutes come and others of that sort of experimental end of the sexual curriculum and advise and counsel and lecture on interesting aspects of sexuality that you poor ordinary kids haven't yet really learned about. What a terrible profanation of a great university. Or am I overstating the case?
No, you're not. There's a good book on Sex Week at Yale titled Sex and God at Yale.
Yes, picking up on Buckley's old title.
Yes. The Bowdoin has not a Sex Week, but some steps in the same direction, and I'm glad you've given me the opportunity to bring that up because it's a controversial aspect of our report. As I mentioned, in 1969, Bowdoin eliminated all its academic requirements. There was no single course that every student had to take, and that has remained the case to this day.
Brown University did that some time ago, I believe.
Around the same time, actually. But there is a partial exception to this. Although it's not an academic course, it is a piece of a required something that in a college that requires hardly anything, and that's why it matters. During the first day of student orientation, when new students arrive on campus, they are required to sit for a play that runs about 45 minutes. The title of the play is Speak About It, and the actors are upperclassmen. It is organized by the Dean of Students' Office and has been in use now for 5 or 6 years. Speak About It consists of students coming onto stage, usually in couples, and they are thinking about the sex acts that they had just performed, the ones that they're about to perform, or they are in the midst of performing, and they're partly speaking to each other and partly in soliloquy, expressing various forms of lust. And this goes on with gay couples, lesbian couples, heterosexual couples for the full 45 minutes. At the conclusion of it, one of the actors breaks character and steps to the front of the stage and says something like this: "Remember, at Bowdoin, you're free to do whatever you want, with whomever you want, whenever you want. But just remember, when you're doing it, you always need to have." And she holds her arms up, and the whole comes forward and says in unison the one thing that you must have. That one thing is consent. This is not an enterprise of students acting up. It's an official Bowdoin event. It's required of all the students. Bowdoin thinks well enough of it that it's taken it on the road and presented it at other colleges.
I remember a famous comment by Clark Kerr, who was the head of the University of California at some point, who said he has three basic problems: a football for the alumni, parking space for the faculty, and sex for the students.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bowdoin has solved that problem. It doesn't end with the play Speak About It. Inside the door of every dorm on campus is a bowl of condoms with a sign on it urging students to themselves.
Yeah.
I've heard of parents showing up on campus and encountering this with just being aghast at it.
Yeah.
But what seems to have happened here is that the college went way beyond the idea of safe sex to engaging in the promotion of sexual promiscuity among students as part of what student life should be like. They're successful, we know, because each year one of the classes does a campus-wide poll of how many students are engaged in what's now called the hookup culture, and we know about three-quarters of the Bowdoin students profess that, yes, they have multiple partners through hooking up, which means essentially sex without emotional connection.
There is an organization established a few years ago at the University of Chicago, which essentially is a sort of an exchange for hookup contacts, and which serves the hookup culture not merely at the University of Chicago, but presumes to do so for other campuses as well. Well, students are always interested in sex, to be sure, but there's something truly disheartening about the sexualization of campus life. That should be left. Well, I could sputter and go on like the old moralist I've become, but where it isn't offensive, it's just really ludicrous.
Well, let me add just two short comments to that. One is that we know from the students writing into the student newspaper that by the time they're seniors, especially the women,
they're
very disenchanted with it.
They are hurt by it. That's true.
They realize how much they've been hurt by it and the difficulty that they will subsequently have forming lasting emotional ties.
I talked last year to a woman psychiatrist from University of California who indeed did a whole book on that. That was her major finding with her sexually liberated young women.
The other thing to say about this, and this might be a little bit more controversial, is that in the report, I draw the connection between the dissolution of academic standards and the rise of promiscuity on campus.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's not a simple cause and effect, but the point is something like this, that the college decided in the late 60s that student autonomy, the individual choosing his own way, was the only principle that they could really uphold in an educational system.
Yeah.
And they're applying the same principle to the moral lives of students. You're making your choices, as long as you make them in a manner that involves consent of other people, nothing can be bad about it.
Well, Peter, we're just about out of time, but I can't resist simply asking you an impossible question. Could one somehow reassure oneself by remembering that this too shall pass, or rather, is this a permanent transformation of the American Academy?
The short answer is that those who have gone through education in this form have missed something probably permanently. They will be altered for their whole lives by this. Will American higher education remain in this slough of despond forever? No, I don't think it will. There are complex changes afoot, some of them involving distance education, but others involving a resurgent spirit of people wanting more morally in their character and in their minds than what the current system provides. So in a mild way, I'm optimistic. I do think we will eventually recover from this, but not without another lost generation.
Now, there are some colleges that have emerged in trying to restore the tradition of American higher education and American liberal education, so-called truly liberal in the old sense. But also there are individual programs. It's interesting to learn that there is one in one department even at Bowdoin, but surely programs established in the various universities, including Princeton for one, seem to be an attempt to restore some reasonable values and standards and somehow reward serious intellectual life once again.
Yeah, it's encouraging to know that these programs exist, and they do exist, and they grow in number each year. And I applaud that. At the same time, I realize that those programs really reach only the students who arrive at college with some knowledge of that that's an option. Most students don't know that.
You've got one such program at Princeton, the town where you are located, and that's the one run by Robbie George.
Yes, I should correct you on one point.
You're no longer located there.
Located at Princeton.
I know.
25 years, we've now moved to New York City.
Yeah, I just remembered that even as I said it. Is that a good change for you?
It's been a really good change for us. We are closer to the mass media. We have closer access to our funding base, and our membership finds it a lot easier to see us in New York than it did in Princeton, lovely as Princeton is.
And I am delighted that we were able to talk with you about it tonight, or rather today, and we are about somebody's calling on a phone, so I've got to say goodbye. But thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted as usual.
Somebody